Well, welcome to today's Senate occasional lecture, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Jackie Morris. I'm the Clerk Assistant Procedure in the Department of the Senate. In welcoming you, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the country that we meet on today, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples, and their elders past and present. Compulsory voting was introduced in Australia in 1924 to overcome a particularly low voter turnout of 55% at the federal election in 1922. With almost a century of experience with compulsory voting in Australia, we have two researchers with us today to ask and hopefully answer the big questions about this experience. Is it working? Do people like it? Does its justification still hold today? Our first speaker is Professor Lisa Hill, a political theorist in electoral studies and liberal democratic theory based at the University of Adelaide. Lisa has literally written the book on compulsory voting, making the Four Case in a joint publication with Jason Brennan, who is a vocal critic of compulsory voting based in the United States. We've had two federal elections since the book was published, so I'm interested to know whether Lisa remains optimistic about compulsory voting. Our second speaker, Dr. Jill Shepherd from the Australian National University, researches political participation. Jill has described herself as a survey expert, which is some suggestion of the scale of the projects she contributes to, including the Australian Values Study, which surveyed 1,800 people last year. Jill is an investigator for the Australian Election Study, including its major project on political engagement in the young. Would you please join me in welcoming Dr. Shepherd and Professor Hill?
Thank you, Jackie, for that lovely welcome. And I'm very happy to be here to talk about compulsory voting, which I've been studying for about 20 years now. Now, can you hear? The microphone's on. How about that if I talk? I will actually talk louder because I'm a singer. I have big lungs. Now, you probably all know who Marion Saw is. She's a very famous Australian political scientist. She once described Australia as the first nation created not by revolution but through the ballot box. And she meant by the referenda that brought the nation into existence, but she also means the sense in which our political culture and our political identity has been very much shaped by our electoral system and our focus on parliament rather than, say, rights and things like that. Now, our democracy, you may or may not be aware of this, is a model for democracies the world over, our electoral democracy, because our system has been marked by a lot of innovation. And I would say that compulsory voting has been our most important innovation, our least adopted, but probably our most important. Almost all our other innovations have been adopted by other places. We weren't the first place to use compulsory voting. Some other places got there before us in the late 19th century, but we are one of the few advanced democracies, established democracies to use it, and the only English-speaking country to use it. And we're a very good example of a highly successful regime that's constantly experimenting with improvements, improvements at integrity, improvements at accessibility, and improvements at inclusiveness. And we have probably, I would probably think, the most inclusive electoral regime in the world, on a par with some smaller democracies like perhaps Malta and Denmark. About 30 democracies, some say 40, worldwide claim to use compulsory voting, but about half that really use it properly. You've really got to have the right infrastructure in place and you've got to follow it up with sanctions and enforcement. Vanuatu and Samoa are currently working towards adopting compulsory voting to solve some of their problems, political corruption problems and vote buying, and to close the gender voting and representation gaps. And when asked whether I thought that would work, I think it will work, from what I know about compulsory voting. There's a cover of my book in which I duked it out with Jason Brennan, an American libertarian who does not like compulsory voting. Now, compulsory voting exists where the state imposes a legal requirement to vote, but of course you would know that that's a misleading term. Nobody's requiring you to formally or even mark the ballot at all. It's just attendance. And when the Netherlanders had compulsory voting, which they dropped in 1970s, they even had a term for that, compulsory attendance. They formally recognised that it was just attending. And if anyone's from the Netherlands, please help me, but I think it's opkomstplicht. But that just means compulsory attendance to vote, but not to vote, not to actually vote. Now, we got compulsory registration in 1911. Jackie also told you that we got followed up with compulsory voting in 1924. And if you want to read about some more about that, Judith Brett has written an excellent book about the history of our electoral system, including compulsory voting. Now, aside from regularising the electoral roll, it was introduced to address the problem of low turnout, and it was extremely decisive and successful remedy. We had turnout in about just close to 59% registered voters. We thought that was a disaster, as other places are often quite grateful to get that. We thought it was terrible. We introduced compulsory voting. Just like that, we got a 32% surge, which is sort of the magic number. About 30% is the magic number if you introduce compulsory voting or drop it. When Chile dropped compulsory voting a few years ago, immediate drop by 30%. And since then, it's consistently stayed in that 91 to 95% range, excessively high for an advanced democracy, and it stayed that way all the time. Now, the remaining questions I want to talk about for today are these. Under what conditions is it a good idea to have compulsory voting? And under what conditions is it not a good idea? Why is compulsory voting so well tolerated here by Australians? Does compulsory voting achieve nothing more than raise turnout? Some people say, well, it just raises turnout and achieves nothing else. I want to examine that question. Some people say compulsory voting makes citizens more apathetic. They even say it makes citizens more stupid. They actually use that word. They also say that it makes our governments less effective. So I briefly talk about whether those two things are true. And finally, whether compulsory voting is a violation of democratic values, or does it in some respects serve democratic values? Now, it's not appropriate for all settings, only those that meet certain conditions, and where it also has a very good chance of being administered properly. You can't compel people to do something that it's hard for them to do. People won't tolerate it, and it's not ethical. For it to be effective in terms of assuring high turnout, accepted in terms of having a high level of public tolerance, you've got to have any compulsion to be accepted by the public, otherwise you're going to get a lot of trouble. And it's got to be appropriate, because there can be ethical problems. It can be used as a mechanism to forge consent or to legitimise one-party contests. So in order to make sure that's not happening, you have to have a few things. First of all, a well-established system of democratic institutions with adequate civil and political rights protection, including universal suffrage. You've got to have, obviously, the apparatus of constitutionalism, limits on political power, and free and competitive and fair elections. It should be what I call an authentic democracy. We are an authentic democracy to a very high degree. It should also, if you can have it, a developed national infrastructure, reasonable levels of cooperation between regional and central governments, particularly within federal structures, because if you've seen the case in America, things go horribly wrong because their federal and state governments are always at war with each other. Not here. There's a high degree of cooperation at the electoral level. And professional, well-funded, independent and accountable electoral officers. Again, we have that. We have that partly because we've had compulsory voting. Once it was decided that we would use compulsory voting, we decided also that if we're going to compel people to do it, let's do it properly. And it drove our incredibly efficient and well-run electoral regime. Now, what else would you need? You have to make sure that voting's not a burden on people, that there are few opportunity and transaction costs to voters. By that I mean you don't have to miss out on work or a fun activity to vote. You don't have to travel a long distance. You don't have to say either I'll go to the pool or I'll vote. You can see these people are all half naked because they know they're on their way to the beach. They know they won't be waiting in long queues. They know they won't get to the end of the queue and someone say, oh, we've run out of ballots and now I'm closing the booth, which happened in Britain recently. That does not happen here, as it never has. So there's very low cost to voters. You get so much help with registration. You don't have to vote if you're more than 8 km from a polling place. Everything is done that could possibly be done to help you. Further, you do need sanctions. They should be applied consistently. It doesn't work if you don't have sanctions, but they should be not applied with zealotry. You shouldn't make people feel like a criminal, hunt them down like a dog. You just do what we do here, but you make sure people know we will follow up. I noticed you didn't vote. Would you mind paying the fine or write a letter explaining why you didn't vote? It's like that. And that is the great balance that we have here. Now, it's also preferable if there's some degree of genuine choice. You can't herd everybody into vote and then give them terrible choices at the polling place. Now, one way you can control that institutionally is to have some level of proportional representation or preferential voting, so some people can get something that they might like or hate least. there has to be some degree of meaningful representation. And I've looked at settings where they didn't have that and people just submitted a lot of spoiled or blank ballots. But where there's some meaningful choice, as we have here, you don't get that problem. Public acceptance is just so important. Now, one of my interlocutors, my adversaries on compulsory voting, Annabel Lever, says that compulsory voting does nothing more than raise turnout. That's not true. It does a lot more than raise turnout. But I just want to pause to remind you that she's talking as though it's a trivial thing to raise turnout. In other systems that are voluntary, if they can get a 2-point rise in turnout, they're ecstatic. So it's not a trivial thing that we've managed to keep turnout in the 90% plus range. Others say that there are less coercive ways of raising turnout. You can do Saturday voting, absentee voting, lowering the voting age, proportional representation, giving people incentives to vote, improving registration, doing all kinds of stuff, some of which we already do to just improve things. They will raise turnout, but not by not much. They're not very effective. If you put all that stuff together, you still wouldn't get the same turnout raising power that you get from compulsory voting. Which, it's, in some settings, it's only raised turnout by 12 percentage points, which actually in electoral studies is a lot, but usually it's around 30 percentage points, which is a real lot. And when it's administered properly, it's the only mechanism that can achieve turnout rates of these 90% and above on its own. So when people say there are other ways of doing getting the same turnout rates, there really aren't. I checked. There just aren't. You can't do it. The other thing that's good about it is its effect on turnout is immediate. It happens like that. You don't have to wait for political culture to change. You don't have to wait for young to work out they're allowed to vote at a younger age. It happens straight away, and it lasts. It has an enduring effect. So it's had a great effect here in Australia in terms of not only raising our turnout, but it expanding the franchise. In voluntary system, it's usually just the prosperous that vote. When we introduce compulsory voting, suddenly everyone's voting from all the social cleavages, especially the most disadvantaged and marginalised. And that will happen wherever a compulsory voting system is properly administered. Now, I've got... This is a picture here I got from Jill, but she's got a nicer one coming up in her talk. This comes from the Australian Election Study. And the question here is, do Australians mind about compulsory voting? No. No matter how grumpy they are about something, over time, they keep telling you, around 70% keep telling you, they're fine with compulsory voting. So what you need to really worry about is just the top two lines. Those all add up to around 70% over decades. Also, the vast majority comply with the laws, even though it's quite easy to get out of it, but they still comply. In fact, voting here is so cost-free that failure to vote is more trouble than actually voting. Writing that letter is more trouble. So this goes to my point about why Australians are so accepting of compulsory voting. And again, it's related to our very high levels of electoral management integrity. It's easy here because the state covers all the costs. It's not a great burden on a person. If you ask an American what they have to do, it's quite horrific. Even someone in the UK, it's quite hard to vote, whereas here it's quite hard not to vote. Further, the penalties are applied consistently but without zealotry. You're not annoying people, you're not making them feel like a criminal if they forget, if they're ill, or if they had a punctured tyre on the way. It's an honour system. You treat people respectfully and as adults. If they tell you they had a... If you tell the AEC that you had a flat tyre, they will believe you. In turn, Australians tend not to lie about it. They're honest about it and they act like adults about it. Third, there's a high degree of trust in our electoral process. We do have occasional problems. We have had some high-profile cases, but millions upon millions upon millions of Australian votes have been processed by our electoral commissions without any controversy whatsoever, because our electoral officers are organised, integrated, professional, reasonably well-funded, independent, accountable and apolitical. And anyone that's ever worked with an electoral commission would know they make your eyes hurt with the extent to which they are determined to be apolitical and to have integrity. I've done some projects with them. And on the one hand, it was hard work, but on the other hand, I found it tremendously reassuring how high their standards are. So Australians have faith in the mechanics of their electoral process, with the effect that the accuracy and procedural legitimacy of outcomes is rarely, if ever, disputed. Australians will complain, "Oh, I didn't like that party," like anyone else, but you very rarely hear an Australian say that election was rigged, that was interfered with, that was not the outcome I was expecting. They have quite a high degree of faith there. And when asked what they like most about their democracies, Australians rated highly that elections are free and fair. Jill's going to be talking about declining levels of trust among the population, but one of the things that's still there is they trust their electoral process. And it was compulsory voting, as I mentioned, that drove this high standard. A study by some political scientists at UTS on voter choices is also finding that Australians, even if they don't get their candidate to win, are still happy with the choices they had. They felt there was enough choice on the ballot and they're still happy with who they voted for. And one thing that I find quite funny and kooky is that Australians actually place more value in obeying laws than do citizens in compulsory voluntary voting regimes. Now, we always think of Australians, well, I do, as sort of naughty and a bit wild. And they are a bit. But where it comes to laws, Australians, I mean, you've got to obey the law. They also are rated highest on, you must pay your taxes. And they also say, you must vote. They're sticklers about those sort of things. And I think it's because, unlike in most other places, all Australians feel invested in laws because everyone voted for the lawmakers. They feel that they have consented to these laws. They feel that they have signed the social contract. And that will also go to why it's quite a stable society. And the other thing that I find quite interesting about Australians is they tend to see voting more as a duty than a right. So they're not going to be too annoyed by being compelled to vote because they feel it's their duty to vote. And when the International Social Survey Program Citizenship Survey, I don't know why they have survey twice in their name, found that they asked all these people from different countries, 29 countries, what is the mark of a good citizen? Australians ranked first and strongest than anybody else. Always voting in elections. You must vote. They feel it's their duty. So Australians regard compulsory voting as a fairly acceptable imposition on their individual autonomy, except for the 30% that don't think that. And even Edward Mann, the Nationalist Party member who promoted the bill in 1924, acknowledged at the time that it was a constraint on liberty. However, he concluded overall, individual liberty is less likely to be invaded when the legal control is that exercised by the real majority of the people. So he understood something that John Stuart Mill has always said. Your vote is your insurance policy against abuses of power, whether by the state or by a private body. It will protect you. And if everyone's voting and everyone's watching, there are less likely to be incursions on your rights, which turns out to be true. He was exactly right. However, there are some people that see compulsory voting as antithetical to democratic ideals, and it is, in a way, compelling people to vote. That's true. It doesn't feel right. It jars against the democratic ideal, I guess. And it certainly is an imposition on personal autonomy, but whether it's an unnecessary imposition is the real question. Now, some people say it's an unnecessary imposition because they say low turnout is nothing to worry about. Some even say it may be a good thing. Now, Annabel Lever says that the reason people abstain in voluntary systems is because they're happy to go along with what others decide. In other words, she's implying that they confer tacit consent. By the way, Annabel is a theorist, as am I. But I like to stay friendly with the quants people and see what's going on there in the real world. So I said to myself, I think I'll check that. I got all the data I could find on the attitudes of habitual voters versus habitual non-voters. Turns out habitual voters are as happy as Larry. Habitual non-voters are very grumpy, very unhappy, very disaffected and alienated. So it's not tacit consent they're conferring, something else. Ben Saunders also says that as long as a country has universal suffrage and low turnout, it's not a problem. As long as everyone's entitled to vote, that's all you need. And Annabel Lever says that too. And so they're no less legitimate if your turnout's very low. So then I thought, maybe I'm the problem. Maybe I'm fetishising numbers. Then I thought, well, is the legal right to vote enough? Or, hang on, how low is too low? When do they say it's not okay anymore? 50%, 40%, 20%, 15%, as you'll get in some American gubernatorial elections? Are we even still calling that democracy anymore? And what if nobody votes, but everyone has a legal right to vote? I'm not okay with this, I think. The other thing I wondered about, which I thought might be some political scientists say it, that you're just getting more of the same information. It's not qualitatively different information. So what difference does it make? You're still getting understanding what the preferences of voters are. Who cares? And they determine that with polls. But I think I checked looking at the behaviour of government to see if that was true. If we're getting the same, just more of the same, or more diverse types of input from voters. So does obtaining more information give us qualitatively different information? Yes. When turnout is high, more diverse inputs are captured, which in turn causes the representatives to think and behave differently when they formulate policies and allocate resources than when turnout is low. Behaviour is very different. There's no shortage of studies which prove that. And now I want to sort of start to wind down with this comment by Jason. He says that compulsory voting is actually harmful. It's like a magic wand that makes the electorate dumber about politics. Government tends to give people what they want, and compulsory voting should produce somewhat lower and more incompetent government. And when I saw that should, I thought, he's a theorist. He's probably just guessing. So I did a little checking. Are governments worse? Are people dumber under compulsory voting? No, they are not worse. Well, I have to admit that I was like, how dare you? You know, you're talking about my country, saying we're dumber and are my governments worse than an American government? Give me a break. So I checked. It's very doubtful that compulsory voting governments are worse. First of all, we know that compulsory voting correlates with lower levels of political corruption. We're already ahead of the game. No one's going to tell me that corruption's a good thing. They also have less income inequality because they don't just represent well-off voters. Governments are more responsive and more representative. And people have even done studies that show when a certain constituency, in this case African-Americans, entered the electorate, suddenly they had garbage collection, and suddenly they had street lighting. Governments respond. All politicians know this. So because it delivers high and socially diverse turnout, it makes government more representative of the people as a whole. In voluntary systems, it just looks after the well-off. As Walter Dean Burnham once said, if you don't vote, you don't count. Everybody knows that, except all the people I'm debating. I don't know why they don't know it. Everyone knows that. And there's no shortage of studies that show that government attention is more evenly distributed under compulsory voting. And that's as it should be. Governments aren't supposed to just serve the people that voted, and they're not just supposed to serve the people that voted for them. They're supposed to serve everybody. And that's what compulsory voting makes governments do. Compulsory voting is also correlated with high levels of satisfaction with democracy, both here and elsewhere, although Jill's going to talk about some downward trends there. But I think not in relation to compulsory voting, because they also still have faith in the mechanics of our system. Also, excuse me, but citizens in compulsory voting regimes are not politically dumber. Not my word. In fact, they are more attentive to the behaviour of their governments than citizens in voluntary regimes and more politically sophisticated. And actually, the first person to come out with this published study was Jill. And then some others followed. These are papers that are now published by Victoria Shinneman, and then we have one by Cordova and Rangel. And more and more papers are coming out that show this now. I should end on this point. Look, does CV violate personal autonomy? Of course it does. If you compel someone to do something, it's a violation of your autonomy. But is it an unwarranted and unjustified one? Governments ask people to do things all the time that they would probably prefer not to do or retrospectively agree they probably should have. But anyway, we have problems of collective action. We have to build roads. We have to build schools. We need to tax people, so we do that. We get people to pay taxes, to do jury duty, to send their children to school. Compulsory voting imposes a fairly minor imposition on your freedom in exchange for what you get, which is all this stuff. Now, you might not want all this stuff, and you might say, my choice to abstain is more important. But if you do want this stuff, I think it's a pretty good deal. You get more legitimate government, because now you've gathered all the preferences of everybody you've checked. It's more representative. You are serving the political equality goal, which is at the centre of democratic ideals, one vote, one value. Your system's more inclusive, which democracies are supposed to be. You're minimising elite power, which on most definitions of democracy, not all, is an ideal. You have uncorruption, a less corrupt democracy, which we all want, and your government is more responsive. I think I better stop there and let Jill take over. Thank you.
Well, first of all, I want to thank everyone for coming, especially people in the room who know me and have heard this shtick before. When Lisa and I were asked to come and give this lecture, the organisers in the Senate didn't know that we're actually very good friends and in fierce agreement on most of the things that Lisa's just talked about. But as a lot of you in the room do know me, you know that I'm happy to be a contrarian for the sake of interests. So I'm going to sort of problematise a few of the things that Lisa's just talked to you about, and I'm also, because it's my personal inclination, going to throw a heap of numbers at you. If anything doesn't make sense, if things are unclear, please don't hesitate to interrupt me, or if you can't hear at any point. So I'm going to focus a lot on the quantitative, the kind of knowable effects of compulsory voting. And while my instinct is to agree deeply with Lisa's arguments that compulsory voting is a really easy, quick fix to a lot of problems of political culture that we see around the world, there are some things that it probably doesn't do very well, and there are some things that can be achieved in the absence of compulsory voting. So first of all, I'm going to talk about the first order and what we call the second order effects. It's a very sort of academic jargony way of just talking about there are things that are obvious direct effects of compulsory voting, namely voter turnout. If you make someone vote the next day, and this happened in 1924, the next day we know that voter turnout jumps by anywhere from 10 to 30 percentage points. And that's as it should be. That's if you're going to have a law, enforce it and make sure that it actually has an effect. But then there are some downstream effects that we kind of hand wave about. We think that they're due to compulsory voting, and we do have a tendency in this country to attribute everything to compulsory voting. But there's increasing evidence for a lot of these claims that they are actually having effects on political behaviours and political attitudes beyond just turning up on election day. And we do fall into this trap. I think Lisa and I both do. Certainly our colleagues in Australian political science do sometimes, I think, take compulsory voting for granted. We see something about Australia that's a little bit different and we go, it's compulsory voting. And it probably is, but we kind of have to stay vigilant about this. So on this effect of voter turnout, this is just, I hope you can see them, but they're just dots representing percentage voter turnout in a range of countries, too many countries to bother naming. The ones that are interesting are Belgium at the far left in red and yellow. Belgium consistently has the highest voter turnout in the world, whether we are counting voter turnout with a denominator of everyone in the electorate who is of a voting age or people who are enrolled to vote. Now, as Lisa mentioned, the compulsion to make people enrol to vote is really hard to enforce. And traditionally in Australia, the best way to abstain has just been to never enrol to vote. The AEC had no way of knowing you, that you just didn't exist as far as the Electoral Commission was concerned. That's changed recently with an update to the law that has allowed the AEC access to data on coming of age or changing address or moving to the country. So the AEC gets an alert that someone's turned 18, someone's moved to the country, they've become a citizen, they can vote, but they're not on the electoral roll. So the AEC can, without coercing them too much, enrol them automatically. And so that has changed things in Australia. You can't just opt out of the enrolment system altogether. And then the red dot on just to the right of Belgium, that's Australia. That's showing that as a proportion of the voting age population, Australia does have pretty much the highest turnout. Now, that jumps around a little bit, but we're doing pretty well. There are countries up there in the left, though, Denmark among them, and I think the Netherlands might be one, but the Netherlands jumps around as well, who are achieving these rates of voter turnout without compulsion. So is this something we could do? Lisa talks about the infringement on civil liberties, that we're actually making people go and do something that they may not want to do. And for a lot of liberal democracies, that is, a bridge too far. Americans really don't want to talk about compulsory voting. Lisa's friend Jason Brennan, thinks it's better off if fewer of us vote and we'll just let those of us with PhDs and bachelor degrees vote and we'll all be much happier. There are ways of achieving high turnout without compulsion, but you need every star to align. You need to be Denmark with a rich political culture, with a fairly homogenous population, with a strong history of democracy and democratic engagement. We can't go back and re-engineer Australia. We are who we are now. Our political culture is largely contingent on compulsory voting, and so we don't know the parallel universe in which we haven't had compulsory voting for almost 100 years, but it's very likely that we wouldn't have the high rates of voter turnout that a lot of Northern European countries see without compulsory voting. So it's kind of there, but for the grace of God, I think, in the Australian case. Looking now at the downstream effects. And again, we've sort of hand-waved about this for years and it's been nice to be able to do so. A lot of the shift in political science, unfortunately, and in academic publishing has asked us to come up with better evidence. And it's probably good for the sake of the discipline and for the study of it. So Carreras in 2016 finds something that we have probably assumed, and that it's that compulsory voting doesn't make us any more likely to write to our MPs, to sign a petition, to actually do things that we might say have a kind of tangible outcome. We're not more likely to join political parties. We are, though, more likely to talk about politics. My colleague Ian McAllister has a quote from a paper almost 20 years old now that says, if nothing else, compulsory voting makes us think superficially about parties. We have, and I will show you in a couple of slides, about the highest rates of identifying with a party in the world. Most of us in the room, even if we think we're pretty independently minded, think about ourselves as being a Liberal voter or a Labor voter. And we know increasingly that people will describe themselves as independents. You know, I change my vote all the time. And we'll tell this to survey researchers like me, to pollsters and everyone else, but we still vote the same way most of the time. Voting is very sticky. And the identity that we start with, the identity usually that we learn from our parents, sticks with us through our life. So to the extent that compulsory voting does make us talk about politics or does make us more engaged, it's that we talk about parties. We talk about the leaders that we like. We talk about the parties that we like and probably increasingly the parties that we don't like, because we know that the opposite party and supporters of the opposite party are part of our political identity too, and the hatred or the resentment that we feel towards those people becomes part of our personal, our political personality. So it's not having a great effect on behaviours that we can actually make sense of and count. It's just that discussion. We do know, as Lisa mentioned, that enforced compulsory voting, and the enforcement here is really important, makes us more inclined to seek out political information. And again, this kind of makes sense. If you know you have to go and vote, you might, at least for the last week of the campaign, vaguely tune in. Now, I say this as someone who does my very best to resist watching any news, but at some point in the campaign, I do kind of think, well, I better check what the policies are, and then I end up voting the same way anyway. But I do make some effort, and even those of us who describe ourselves as deeply uninterested in politics, as not at all engaged, we know that they do make a little bit more effort. We know from research that I published in 2015, and you don't have to understand these graphs, I just wanted to put them there so I looked a bit more convincing. We know that in countries with strongly enforced compulsory voting, that even people who aren't very well educated, even people who left school in, before they graduated high school, know more than the average person across the world about politics. And that's really important. And that's what Lisa spoke to with regards to that sort of political equality argument. Even people who would never vote if they're in the US, if they're in the UK, even if they're in New Zealand, they know more than the average bear about politics. And that's really important. We also know that it has an effect on policy outcomes. And again, this is about equality of representation. If you don't vote, parties don't care about you. And if you're not likely to ever vote, if you're not a mobilisable voter, then why bother? Why bother listening to your demands? When people with very low socioeconomic resources, low education, low income, low wealth, when they vote, as they do in Australia, we know that policy turns to the left. Now, you might not like this, and that's fine, but we know that compulsory voting does lead to more socially and economically progressive policies. Now, it's easy to say, sit here and say, yeah, but it took us so long to get same-sex marriage, for instance. What's going on there? And I'll get back to that. Park that, because we're not perfect. But in opposition to Jason Brennan's argument about compulsory voting making the median voter dumber, making them less engaged, less interested, the counter to that is it's not about being less smart, it's not about being less sophisticated, it's that the preferences of that median voter, the person who can swing the election result, they have different preferences in a compulsory voting system than in a voluntary voting system. And that's important for policy outcomes. I preempted this, but Australia has the highest rate of party loyalty in the world by some way. We decide the party that fits our identity very early. We usually adopt this from our parents, and we stick to that for life. we are Liberal voters or we are Labor voters. It's about 90% of the population in Australia who we survey in the Australian election study say that they feel closest to one of, that they feel more closely to one or more parties, basically. And they might feel only weakly close, but they feel close to one of the parties. And if you asked them, who do you vote for, they would describe themselves as a Labor voter, as a Greens voter. Now, that's not necessarily a good thing either. We tend to think in a democratic society that it's good if you can jump around, that makes the parties more responsive. And so this is a problem. It also means the parties don't really care if we're members or not, because we're going to go out and vote anyway. Counter to this is that Cyprus, which is just the second to the left here on this chart, which has only recently gotten rid of its fairly well-enforced compulsory voting regime, has around the highest rates of political party membership in the world. So it's not necessarily the case that that compulsory voting is driving down political party membership, but all of these things are on a theme that I'm going to get to about Australian politics. Australia is about where the arrow is, sort of in between Slovakia and the Czech Republic, both former autocracies. We don't have great levels of engagement with the parties in Australia, even though we feel so strongly about them. And my argument is this, and this is a bit of a black box. I don't have any data for this yet. If I get funded for a big project, I'll have plenty of data in a few years, if there's any academic peer reviewers in the room. And we tell everyone around the world, we have the most stable system in the democratic world. Why wouldn't you want us? Why wouldn't you want to be us? Why don't you want compulsory voting? We can't convince anyone. Lisa's written books about it and no one listens to us. Why don't you want a combination of preferential voting that creates a stable two-party system, proportional representation in the Senate, which gives voice to more marginalised groups, and strongly enforced compulsory voting? What's not to love? And increasingly, I think it's this. It's that the parties don't care. We're going to go vote anyway. All Labor has to do is be just to the left of the Liberal Party. All the Liberal Party has to do is to be just to the right of the Labor Party. The Greens are out on the left and no one's really listening to them. You've got One Nation out on the right and no one's really listening to them. They're pretty marginalised. The Liberals don't really care if you go and vote for One Nation because they're going to get your vote back at the end of the night. And, you know, we saw this in real time on election night this year, votes coming back. Oh, are the Liberals going to lose the seat of Leichhardt, for instance? No, because preferences brought it back throughout the night. The parties don't really have to care. They just have to be as close to the centre as possible. And so we don't get action on climate change. We don't necessarily get a meaningful response to public concern about asylum seeker treatment. These are the sorts of problems that I think aren't endemic to compulsory voting, and we can't necessarily blame compulsory voting for them. But I think we're at a point where the parties are starting to take us and this for granted. Nonetheless, support, as Lisa said, remains incredibly high. We also have about between 70 and 80 for the most part of the population who say they'd vote anyway. And I'm a bit dubious about this because it's easy to say you do things and harder to actually do them. But then we see with the same-sex marriage plebiscite that we had voter turnout of 85%. And I will say that in a competition that we had on Twitter to guess the turnout and guess the result among a bunch of political scientists, that I won that. No one else thought that so many people would turn out. But I said, no, people love it. They love to vote. We have what's sometimes, you know, sort of glibly called a paperwork culture. We're happy to fill out government forms. We're happy to obey the law. We're pretty bloody authoritarian, you know, and it's not a nice thing to think about, but we genuinely are. Nonetheless, we love compulsory voting, but we hate the parties. No more than 22% of us at the moment think that parties care what we think. Why are we so complacent? Why are we so obliging about this, turning out for parties that we don't think care about us? I'm a Labor voter. I'm a lifelong Labor voter. I love them. They don't give a stuff what I think. It's incongruent. And I don't know how we deal with this going forward. My solution is to have one election with voluntary voting. What do you reckon? Just one election and see what they have to do. And we might get better leaders. We might just get a little bit more engagement just once, and then we'd lose it again. So, you know, what's the point? But I'd be able to write a book about it. We could co-author a book about it. So the kind of sum total of this is that compulsory voting does create this culture where we talk about politics. We do think about politics, and that's good, but we're not turning that into boots on the ground. We're not joining the parties, probably because the parties don't really care what we think. And as long as we don't believe that the parties care what we think, then we're not going to sign up. And I'm convinced that the parties don't want us to sign up anyway. Members are pains. Members elect Jeremy Corbyn, and no one wants that. I quite like Jeremy Corbyn, but... well, you get Boris Johnson, okay. I've kept everyone in the room happy now. Regardless, we're so happy about it. And I don't know at what point this tension, this incongruous sort of public attitude breaks down. But I think we're at a sort of an important point for the parties at the moment where they have to be wary that we are really starting to turn off. So thank you so much for listening to both Lisa and myself. I hope that I've disagreed with Lisa enough to keep it interesting. And I think now, Jackie, we open for questions.
Thank you. So if you come and join us.
Very gladly.
Right. Thanks very much. Thank you. I suspect there'll be many questions, but the first one's up in the gallery, so we'll go with you.
Thanks very much. I was wondering if you had any thoughts about the system in America where people at elections get to vote on propositions. So there's an issue, they go and vote for whichever politician they want, but they can also vote on a specific proposition. Do you think that would be something that would make the electorate more engaged and would work in Australia or not?
I've got pretty strong views.
Are you talking about citizen-initiated referenda?
Oh, like proposition. You know when you go to California and everything has been voted on?
Yeah.
Proposition 51.
Oh, yes, that giant long ballot paper, yeah.
You get an option to say, do you want to legalise marijuana? Now, you might vote for Donald Trump, but you might also vote to legalise marijuana. So you've got that option on a specific issue to be really engaged, and that might, I don't know, maybe it would work in Australia, maybe it wouldn't, but I'd just be interested if you've thought about it.
I hate them, but I think you've just convinced me that they might be all right because we do have multi-dimensional preferences and you can like Donald Trump on immigration but hate him on the death penalty. That's actually a really good point. I don't like them because they're a big burden on the voter. And Lisa talked about the transaction costs of voting and that when we keep them low, people stay happy and we keep them engaged. When we start asking too much of voters, they'll start to see it as a sort of undue obligation. That's my feel, but
To go to your point, there is a thing called voter fatigue. So Switzerland has very low turnout. People think it's a model of democracy, but the turnout's in the 30s always because they're asked to vote on every damn thing and they get sick of it and they don't turn out. So you have to keep the costs low to the voter. The other thing that concerns me, I see what you're saying about diverse preferences and... you might like Trump, but you might not like his particular policy on something. But my thought there is that it would undermine the deliberative function of the parliament. Mm. Our parliament debates issues, it talks things through, it takes its time, hopefully. What happens in the polling booth is often people get in there and they didn't even know that proposition was there and they're just shooting from the hip a lot of the time, or sometimes they're not. But they're not hearing all sides and they're not taking expert opinion, and that tends to happen in Parliament more. They'll get the parliamentary librarian, like Damon, to write a paper about it and to inform them about it and tell them what the state of play in the research is about something.
Shout out to the parliamentary librarians who do great work.
Parliamentarians themselves aren't just shooting from the hip. They're often drawing on all the data that's available there. So
we hope so.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
This is a fundamental issue that in representative democracy we expect that we elect good representatives who take our views into account. If that trust breaks down, then that's a massive problem.
Do you think that referendums are a good idea?
No, for the same reasons.
Yeah, I don't think, in most cases, they're not needed. Usually people say no for a start, so it's always a cul-de-sac. Secondly, we have... a very strong parliamentary culture. We rely on our... It's a representative democracy. That's the parliamentarian's job. It's their job to respond to us. And often a referendum is something that they don't want to have to think about or don't want to be seen publicly to have a position on. If they know what we want, it's the same with the same marriage equality bill. Politicians knew what we wanted. Just do it. That's your job. So I tend to look at it that way.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got a queue down here, so we'll go to the back mic.
Okay, I'm in favour of compulsory voting. I'll declare
so
my...
So you can stay.
I can stay, yeah. Because I'm pedantic about it, it's attendance at the polling booth. And there are two statistics or areas that I think you've left out of the discussion. There's two ways I can be bolshy once I've got to the polling booth. One is that I can just tear up the paper and write rude things on it and put it in the box. And the other one is that I can do preferential voting and make sure that just before I fall over the cliff, I vote for my particular left of centre or right of centre. What research has been done to have a look at the degree at which over the years people have just put in destroyed ballots into the box, or to what degree have we arrived at the solutions but by a very circuitous route of preferential?
You've written the paper on it.
I've written some papers on informal voting. Now, compulsory voting systems do have high rates of informality. The vast majority is usually around 70% to 75% is unintentional, because you're bringing people with low literacy and numeracy, dominant language competence into the process. So that's not a problem. Eventually, over time, those people catch up. We do have people that deliberately spoil their ballots, usually not by tearing them up. They put in a blank ballot or they write profanity on it. Curiously, hardly anyone writes anything about compulsory voting, like 0.1%. 0.14% write, "I don't like compulsory voting." It's always complaining about politicians, lack of political offer, or just profanity. I wrote a paper with a student of mine. We think young people... there was a spike a couple of elections ago, and I thought that young people might be behind that. They're getting very disaffected by compulsory voting. I like the fact people can lodge an informal vote. What worried me when electronic voting was first put in is that the system wouldn't allow you to put in an informal vote. It kept saying, "You haven't got this right, go back again," you know, as all those programs do. And I was saying, it's very important to have an exit option in a compulsory system. You could also do none of the above. That could be another category.
But the High Court doesn't have a very strong position on whether we are allowed to lodge a blank vote. So if we did move to compulsory electronic voting, we'd have to have a agreed position, and the country doesn't really have it at the moment.
What's allowing it now is paper ballots and the secret ballot, which Australia also pioneered. But this electronic voting, that's a real problem. The courts, it's ambiguous. When you ask a lawyer about it, they're not quite sure whether you actually are supposed to, by law, formally mark the ballot or not. Graham Orr, when I talk to him about it, isn't 100% sure. But the secret ballot allows you to not do that, and I think it's a very good thing because it's information. It's better than abstention in a voluntary system. You're getting some information. For example, a blank ballot, we know in some of the South and Central American regimes, blank ballots go up whenever the government got more authoritarian. It was people's way of saying, "I don't like it." It's information.
Oh, if I can just get... Maybe we might stick with going to the mic because most of the room can't hear you, so we might go to the gentleman at the mic. But please join the queue.
One country that hasn't been mentioned today is New Zealand. It's a country that has a society very similar to Australia's. It's always had voluntary voting, very high turnout, and the outcomes don't seem to be all that noticeably different from Australia. So what's been the position about attitudes towards compulsory voting in New Zealand?
Oh, good question. I don't know how New Zealand... Are you from New Zealand?
No.
Oh, it's usually the New Zealander that says, "Hey, what about New Zealand?"
Well,
New Zealand
have compulsory registration.
New Zealand has an amazing political culture, very high rates of turnout without compulsory voting, and that's a point that I I hope I made, that you can achieve this without compulsion.
However, their turnout's declining, and they have some of those things that you talked about that we can never have. A small, intimate political culture, a much smaller electorate, unitary government, all kinds of things that we've got, all kinds of things that would depress turnout if we didn't have compulsory voting. They've got that. They've got all these things going for them, the same as Malta would have or Denmark has. That you could not possibly engineer a population dispersed on a giant continent.
Yeah, we would struggle here with the federal system. New Zealand has mixed member proportional voting. I won't bore 95% of the room with it. It's a great electoral system. Everyone feels like their voice has been heard.
Yeah.
And that's really important.
Yeah.
And I think that's, at least since it was introduced in the 90s, that's been a huge change. Or 2004, I think it was introduced. It's been a huge change. If we could start the country again, we'd do things a bit differently. But we did all right.
We couldn't shrink the continent, though, I don't think. So we'd still be stuck with this giant country.
Yes, yeah.
Thank you. So the issue of population size has just come up, and that's my question as well. This country is about the size of some of the states in the United States, Florida, New York, California is about almost three times as large. And I'm wondering, what role do you see size as playing in both turnout and in political knowledge? The argument that Jason Brennan would make is, in a very large country, people have no incentive to really get as involved, as informed, because their vote matters so much less, especially if you're not in a swing state in the U.S. Won't a big population country have a problem of ignorance and poor quality participation more than a smaller country?
I think you could get around that with better apportionment of less gerrymandering, I guess, is the more sort of less jargony way of saying it. We have really, really good... So I will introduce the questioner, who is Alex, my new colleague Alex, and learning about Australian politics. We have a very, very stable system of districting. We have very little margin of difference in voters per seats. So everyone is pretty well evenly represented. The problem of geography is big, and Lisa's touched on this. If you are in Western Australia and you don't feel like there's a party or an executive government that is really listening to your views, then they would be hard to potentially engage. I don't know. That feels very hand-wavy of me, though. That's not a very evidence-based answer.
Yeah, we try to accommodate it with the Senate by giving the smaller states extra senators. We also try to accommodate it through allowing people to have some meaningful choice, so we don't have a first-past-the-post system. You can feel that if you're in a faraway place, you can still have some effect on the Senate, and you actually can when you vote because we have PR there. So we're doing probably everything we can do. Considering the size of the continent, it's a pretty intimate political culture. I'm always surprised when I talk to anybody in a shop or in a taxi, they know what's going on.
And in states like Tasmania, everyone's related to a member of parliament.
Jill, I am Tasmanian. Thank you.
I think we should move to the next question.
Thanks very much. I'm interested in what you had to say about political parties and trust in general. And I guess I just wondered, how much do you think is, the product of long-run sort of cycles in Australian politics, and how much do you think is connected to the fact that parties don't really care or want members, which I entirely agree with, and I think it's historically the case over a lot of time. And I guess to that end, is it something that political parties need to address, or do we need to be pushing for other forms of participatory democracy, like deliberative democracy, sortition, some sort of Irish kind of model? What are your thoughts?
Thanks, Maria. Yeah. I'm deeply concerned there's no incentive for the parties to change at the moment. I think the parties don't innovate. I think they are lazy. I think they are increasingly uninterested in the fact that we don't really like them, that they have enjoyed the spoils of party identification for a long time, that we have very loyal voters in Australia. and I don't know how to change that. The parties have made sort of piecemeal reforms to pre-selection processes, to expanding membership types. Throughout Europe, for instance, there are categories of membership. You can just donate and never turn up. You can be a very active member. Someone asked me at a function on Wednesday evening, how do we fix, you know, how do we fix Labor? And I, knowing there are a lot of Labor members in the room, I said to a small group of them, well, stop pre-selecting the same people. Mm. Stop sending us 45-year-old lawyers who have worked as staffers, it's a very easy stereotype to fall into, I know, but, you know, who had law degrees from ANU, who went straight into Parliament. I'm sorry, all my students sitting in front of me. People like you. But it's a thing, and the only way we can resolve that is inside the parties. Now, does that make me want to join a party? No, because who has the hours in the day? So it's circular and there is no answer, and we're doomed to this kind of terrible representation for the next 50 years.
Mm. Some people say it's a function of PR, that it causes parties to move closer to each other. I guess it swings and roundabouts. What you're getting, say, with the proportionality and what you're getting with compulsory voting might be better than what you'd get without it. But one of the things that's worrying me for the future of parties, it's great that we have high party membership because to me that signifies interest and also that you're going to vote. That's one of the greatest single indicators that someone's going to vote. But it's Australian young people are withdrawing from parties. They're not joining anymore. They don't want anything to do with them. They're very disaffected and alienated about parties. And that augurs very poorly for the future of Australian democracy, actually.
But I think the parties are happy with it.
Yes, I do too.
Because it's more tightly. You got a small parliament. A small party. You can control them.
Yes, you can control it. It's easy to compete for bases. You don't have to appeal to that constituency anymore. Young people get more disaffected because they think they're being ignored. They are. Mm. And the more they withdraw, the more ignored they are, and they get into a vicious cycle. So we need to find a way of getting young people into a virtuous cycle, a relationship with parties.
Last question from Mr. Gilby.
Thanks for coming in today. I just want to ask about whether there's any merits of other systems like Brazil, where they have a mixed system. So it's obviously compulsory for 18 to 70-year-olds, I think, and then if you're old after 70 or 16 or 17, it's voluntary. Mm. So are there any sort of merits in that, or do you think it would work in Australia?
I just swallowed some ice. I think you could make that change and it wouldn't, and not much would happen. We know that when voting age gets lowered to 16, that 16-year-olds still don't really vote. And we know that if you've spent your whole life voting, that you're more likely to keep voting. So if we made voting above the age of 70 voluntary, 72-year-olds are still going to vote in higher numbers than 18-year-olds. Brazil's an interesting case because even despite compulsory voting, they have very fluid parties. And a lot of that's been, even though we said that corruption is lower in compulsory voting systems, they've had some fairly corrupt parties. So it's not a panacea.
No, it's not. You have to have all those conditions that I talked about, and Brazil wouldn't be able to meet those conditions. I would like to just say, though, that ethically I would have any problem with a cut-off age with compulsory voting. I think it should be... I think you should be able to vote until you're not capable of voting anymore. Why just tell 70-year-olds they're no longer required? And it could be the thin edge of the wedge of other things. And historically, those sort of qualifications have been used to suppress turnout, usually among marginalised group, although older people aren't marginalised. But I think it could be the thin edge of the wedge. You just shouldn't have a rule like that.
I think time might have defeated us, but I'm sure you could come up and ask when we've concluded. I'm sure they'd be delighted to answer.
Sorry.
No. It's been very entertaining. I've written down that we need to offer a right of reply to Jeremy Corbyn, Boris Johnson, Jason Brennan and 45-year-old lawyers.
And Tasmania.
But as you can see, there's been a very high turnout and participation has been high too. So well done. Thank you.